session number 25452, Real 2.
Major Littleton, Real 2. I was asking about the strength of the signals platoon.
Yes, I would have thought it was maybe 20-odd strong, but certainly not as strong as a full-size 30-strong infantry platoon plus NCOs.
How was it deployed? Did you have detachments or companies?
Usually, if you were on exercises or on training, you would have two or three signalers out at company headquarters, because signals were part of headquarter company, and you would have them out at outstations, either working wireless or whatever circumstances decreed. Signal platoon stuck in the headquarters and no bloody use to anybody.
What did you then have at the headquarters when you were doing an exercise and you had a set up at the headquarters? How was that set up? And
no idea. Can't remember. In what way set up? I mean, the exercise, whatever it was, you deployed your chaps out to outlying stations and you found yourself a location near company commander or what have you, or near battalion headquarters, obviously, and worked that way. It was improvised, same as anything else, depending on the tactics and the exercise objectives.
Did you have a preference for any particular equipment? For example, did you prefer field telephone over wireless or the other way around?
Yeah, I must say one always preferred field telephones because you could communicate better. Even if you couldn't communicate by voice, you could communicate effectively by buzzer. Whereas at that stage, quite frankly, wireless was very, very unreliable. And if you couldn't get a good net, as it was called, of the four or five outstations of the radio, so that everybody could hear what everybody else was doing, the thing broke down in that sense.
If the radio system was working, what sort of range could you get out of it if it was working reasonably well?
Oh, heavens, now you've got me there. It's at this stage of time now, I just cannot remember. And I don't want to make a silly remark in saying it was in terms of miles when it was no more than 2,000 or 3,000 metres or something. I just don't remember.
Did you have dispatch riders in the signals platoon?
Oh yes, they were part of it, so you could always send somebody off. True, they didn't have a vehicle unless they borrowed mine. you obviously, and you had them. Again, thinking back, you had people who had to go from one outstation to another if there was a breakdown or it was necessary, even if they had to walk.
I was going to ask you how platoons would keep in touch with the companies.
Yes.
Presumably, would that be by runner?
I think so. After all, platoon and company headquarters were never far apart. It's not a 30-man platoon needs the very close support of its company and its company headquarters.
While you were doing this, you must have then had the news that you were going off to the Middle East. Do you remember what your feelings were when you heard you were going abroad?
Nothing anecdotally that I can think of. We got embarkation leave at some stage.
Did you have any idea of where you were going?
Apart from the fact we were obviously going to the Middle East, because kit was had to be issued that was khaki drill and so on. So we knew we were going that way, but we didn't know when or how. And though I don't remember it myself, my researches seem to have shown that we were going and then we weren't, and we went, in fact, much later than it was intended. But that isn't from sort of personal knowledge.
How did you get there?
To the Middle East. I think we sailed from Greenock, I think. I'm not quite sure. And on pretty big ships, convoyed, and of course the long way round, via Durban, where we stopped for about a week. Because at that stage, if I remember rightly, we transshipped to three or four big liners, really big liners, majestic type stuff, that could outpace submarines. And we shifted from the tip of South Africa up the Red Sea to Portside Suez in big ships without convoys, for the simple reason that they could go faster. So we had a super time in Durban, I can promise you, because there was the whole atmosphere of seeing lights for the first time and being entertained by the South Africans, who were thrilled with the first troops that had been near them. So it was a great experience. We were pissed the whole time.
At your own expense or at somebody else's expense?
Oh, hospitality was thrown at you.
When you were on the voyage, the first bit of the voyage to Durban, what were the conditions like on the ship?
Fairly crowded, and we had to keep ourselves pretty well fit, so there was much timetabling and routine of runnings and things like that to keep troops in reasonable condition. It was fairly, I can't think how long it is, but you know, it's a long way around. I think we hove to somewhere on West Africa to refuel or something like that, and then set off again. But people had to be kept fit was the major thing.
Do you remember the scale of the convoy, how many ships there were,
No.
and what the escort was like?
No, I don't. There? I don't. Obviously, there were several troop ships involved, but I've no idea of the scale of it. It was a peaceful journey. I don't recall having had any, I think it might have been the odd alarm, but nothing specific. We got through without any troubles.
Now, it's said that on a voyage like that, one of the great problems with troops is not just keeping them fit, as they get bored.
Yeah, keeping them entertained.
Yeah, keeping them entertained. What could you do to keep them entertained, stop them?
Find out what interests were possible. I think those that had some expert knowledge, maybe on some subject, could lecture and talk to them. I'm not sure what sort of entertainment. I can't remember what sort of entertainments we had. But you're quite right in saying that it was very much a factor, apart from keeping fit. You've got to keep them amused. And playing cards isn't for weeks on end isn't the only answer.
Were you able to carry on the signals training at all while you were sailing around to Durban?
I can't be specific about it, but the answer is would be yes, because you had to go on breakfast. You could use your signalling techniques. You didn't have to be out in the field to do that. Keep their Morse code standards up, keep their servicing their wireless sets or their this, that and the other. So you did have specialist platoon training as well as general fitness training and
you
so on.
You would really be responsible for that, wouldn't you?
As a signal officer, oh yes, yes.
Where did you land when you got to Egypt? Was it Port Said or Port... Do you remember where it was?
I don't, presumably. My recollections get a bit dim on the sort of these intermediate things.
Can you remember, you know, your first impression of Egypt when you got ashore?
I don't think we had very long in Egypt, because we moved to Cyprus, I think, fairly soon, fairly quickly. And I have little recollection of sitting around in the Delta at that stage. I had more experience of the Delta later on in the campaign, of course, but at that stage I have no good recollection.
Where did you go to in Cyprus?
Limassol. We were based in Limassol. And very nice place to be. We trained hard there. The Troodos Mountains were handy. I remember acquiring a small yacht and sailing on the coast a bit, and training, and there was a firm called Kehoe, K-E-H-O-E, who made every sort of substitute liquor that there was known. Kehoe brandy and Kehoe this and that and the other. And of course the troops on their leave didn't have use it up, and they would get picked up and they would land up before a court-martial for being drunk and disorderly. And somehow The adjutant at that time was a solicitor, and I don't know, I was perhaps quite good at talking, so I was often employed to defend this brutal and licentious soldiery, none of whom I ever got off, on the grounds that they didn't know what they were doing. But still, it passed the time.
Were you able to put in pleas in mitigation?
Well, only that they were so drunk they couldn't be blamed for what they did. And I don't think that got anybody off the glasshouse or what have you.
What sort of penalties did they
Oh, quite reasonable ones. For, heavens, you can't... quite reasonable ones. Mm. But it was just a sideline on one of the things that went on that I happen to remember.
Do you remember anything in particular about the style of training that you were doing up in the Trudos?
No, because there was no desert training in that sense, because there was no desert, really.
So it was forested mountains.
Indeed. It was a lovely country to be in. I've been back to Cyprus since. It's a very nice place.
How did you get on with the Cypriots?
Not much contact. Not much contact. Except in the towns. I never made any personal friends or contacts with them. We weren't there all that long. I'd forgotten how long we were there. But I don't remember any personal contact much.
What sort of accommodation were the troops in? Were they in...
Under canvas.
Under canvas.
As far as I remember, under canvas, yeah. I think so.
Did you know what you were doing in Cyprus while you were there?
No.
You were just there.
We hadn't been allocated, as far as I could see. We weren't there as a complete division. 151 Brigade, I think, were moved into the desert in the early stages while we did other things and went to Cyprus.
You moved in 41, November, to Haifa. Do you know why that happened, why you were moved to...
Well, I presume it was the first stage in moving into where we ended up that winter in Kirkuk. First we had to get off Cyprus, and we landed up under canvas in Haifa for quite a short time before we made the move across the Iraqi desert to Baghdad and then north to Kirkuk.
Where were you in Haifa? Was this a transit camp of some sort? Was it canvas or...?
I think so, as far as I know it was. Right. That's fine.
I was asking if what sort of accommodation you were in.
As far as I remember, it was tented accommodation the whole time we were there. In fact, I'm sure it was.
How did you get to Iraq?
Well, we followed, roughly speaking, followed the pipeline that was in existence between Haifa and Baghdad or wherever, and convoy, of course, mainly trucks. My vehicle was still the motorcycle, and travelling over hard, rocky desert on the motorcycle day after day is a very hard work. And I was glad when about time before we turned north to from Baghdadish to Haifa, it broke down. And I could throw it into a lorry and sit in beside the driver for the rest of the trip.
This convoy motor transport, was it proceeding in a tactical way with
no
intervals?
No. Oh, not particularly. There was the usual. There was, after all, there was no reason for it to be tactically disposed. The area was a... It wasn't. There was no road at that stage, so it was essentially track. And I sort of remember there was a service called Nair, by somebody called Nair, Nairn Buses, N-A-I-R-N, I think. And they did that sort of journey commercially. And they would sweep past the convoy at about 60 miles an hour, literally gliding over the rocky surfaces. Amazing things.
How did your trucks perform conditions? Did they keep going well?
On the whole, I think quite well. There were breakdowns, but then it was a large convoy, and there were always whippers in to make certain that nobody was left stuck by the time you knocked off for the stop for the night. So everybody was collected in and checked and double-checked, and there was no problems that I remember.
What did you do then when you were stopping for overnight? How were things arranged? Did the trucks go into a log or anything like that? Stop by the side of the road?
I can't remember. I imagine there'd be some sort of organisation. not the sort of lager that was quite a different tactical move in the desert when there was proper war. But I imagine that we would close up, or we'd have to be access to rations and central and cooking facilities, but I've no idea.
And did you have any particular job to do as signals officer on this move?
No, except that being on a motorcycle, I could move up and down the convoy with great ease, and keeping in touch with my battalion headquarters and headquarter company and so on. I was a useful bloke to do whatever I was told to do.
What was essentially a motorised, were you a whipper-in at all towards the end of the day?
Not so much a whipper-in as a moving, doing jobs moving up and down the convoy. Whippers-in was somebody who had to have a proper vehicle and proper kit to change a tyre or what have you. Obviously, if somebody was stuck, they had to have some handy assistance.
Your recovery detachment.
That sort of thing, yes, yeah. I imagine so.
Do you remember any of the jobs you were sent to do that
no.
on the way?
No, not a thing.
Did you go into Baghdad?
No. My recollection is that we moved vaguely into that direction and then turned north. Whether that was because of the geography of the land or not, I can't remember. But we went then north to our final station, which was Kirkuk.
What was that like?
Bloody awful.
What was so awful?
It was middle of winter, it was freezing cold, very basic conditions on the canvas. I will remember in one's canvas washing bowl, the water in the morning would be, if it was left with any water in, would be well and truly frozen. And it was a very miserable winter, one of the worst winters, the worst winter that I can remember.
What did you actually do when you were there then, day to day?
Well, again, we had nothing but training, and because I don't know, I have in my mind the recollection that the object of our going there was to stop the Germans getting at the oil fields. What use one brigade would be in that case, I just cannot imagine.
Well, it would depend upon,
but fortunately, we were not called upon to do out.
It would depend upon what strength the Germans were, if they managed to get...
Well, if they knew there was only one brigade there, they would have adequate strength to deal with it right smartly, I'd have thought.
Well, it would depend on the line of communication.
I suppose so. But that's the only reason that I have in my mind as to why we went to a whole brigade, why we went as far as Kirkuk.
Did you have anything to do with the local population?
No. No. They don't impinge on my thoughts at all. Quite frankly.
Were you actually in defence positions around the oil wells? Was that how you were deployed?
No. As far as I can see, we were fairly centralised because no idea what was going to happen or where we might have to move to. And I don't think you can defend an oil well necessarily by sitting on it. But this is a sort of tactic, a sort of strategy I wouldn't be conscious of knowing. But as I remember, we were more concentrated than actually deployed.
And what sort of training were you doing? Were you going out doing brigade scale?
Yes,
exercises?
Yes, a good deal of that. Mainly general training, and because ultimately we were quite obviously likely to land up in the desert. And this, of course, was the occasion when I was sacked from my signal officer platoon. By Ted Cook Collis.
Why did he sack you?
He said I was bloody inefficient.
Were you?
No, I don't think I was. And I think this was a sort of... My feeling was one of great resentment at the time. In the letters, which I have, you know, these extant letters, I describe my feelings as being very cross and being very unfairly treated and... all of which, on reflection, was probably completely untrue. After all, I was been used to taking part in running our factory at home. I wasn't used to being sacked, and it was a very salutary experience.
Do you remember if there was any particular incident that led to it?
Chiefly the wireless sets wouldn't work.
The wireless sets wouldn't
work? Yes, wouldn't work, and that was my fault.
Did they work better after you'd gone?
I don't think so. I'm not sure. But remember, they were full of sensitive valves that had been bounced thousands of miles over the desert to get there and that sort of thing. And the replacements weren't easy to get hold of and that sort of thing. In any case, Ted Cook Collis decided that he'd had enough of me as a signal officer. And he sent me back to an infantry platoon, which hurt me pride.
What was the terrain like around?
Oh, it started becoming mountainous around that area, so you did have hills and things, as I remember. I don't, my recollections aren't very strong about that period. But, yes, it was a mixed terrain, I think. It's not like the western desert in that sense. It's a great big flat piece of nothingness.
Do you remember anything about the platoon you were sent to command when you were pushed into exile from?
Well, it was back to square one. They were a nice crowd of chaps. I got on well with them once I got over my peak, you know. And we got on fine because I was with them for quite a time after that. And right into the desert, into the Gazala box, and the opening of the German offensive. I was still commanding an infantry platoon. And I was, you know, I was quite happy doing it.
What sort of chaps were they? Where were they all from? Northeast.
Yeah,
Yorkshire.
I think yes. A lot of yes. After all, 50 divs, Tyne and Tees between the two, so they were mostly North Country people.
Do you remember anything about the NCOs or the sergeant?
Not in detail. Not in detail, except that, like as I've said earlier in this interview, when you rely awfully on your sergeant when you're running a platoon.
What does he do for you then? What do you rely on him for?
Stops you making mistakes, chiefly. Stops you making mistakes.
How does he do that? Does he just take you aside for a quiet word, or?
I can't remember. You've got to have it. It's a relationship. Mm. It's a relationship, which is one of those amorphous things that are not easy to define. But you know, if you've got a good platoon sergeant that you can rely on, he'll see that you don't make a balls of things.
And he moved to Syria. Early in 42. Do you remember where you went to in Syria?
I believe it was in area Baalbek area somewhere. Oh. But that's all. I have no recollections of Syria. In fact, they only reminded me of the fact we'd been to Syria when I was doing the research for this interview and discovered that I had been there. Mm. But I certainly was kicking around at that time.
How were you doing your moves? Were you just going by road convoy or motor convoy in the same way as you go?
Oh, I think so, yes.
Okay. So, off to the Western Desert in February 1942, 50
Div. At last we became a full-scale division with the three brigades.
Did you stop at all in Egypt on the way through, or did you just drive straight through?
Can't remember. I have no recollection of those latter moves in detail until we really got into desert conditions in Gazala area.
So you joined the box, Gazala, and what happened to you when you got there?
As you know, it was a major defensive position, so it was wired, it was mined. And we would patrol. We would go out in smallish groups, an infantry company, maybe a troop of 25 pounders, two or three perhaps of Bren gun carriers, and we would have an area to patrol to make certain there was nothing anywhere near us. And occasionally one would come across Germans doing the same. And if there were more of them than there were of us, we ran. And if there were more of us than there were of them, they ran. It was not a question of making contact. It was a question of seeing what was what and where people were, and that was it. And it was part of the fascination of the desert, this patrolling business. You moved on sun compasses, of course, on the end of your vehicle, usually from barrels that had been placed with numbers on them in different parts of your area so that you knew where you were. And it was the freedom of it that made the desert a very fascinating period at that stage. But it wasn't a fighting period then.
When you went out on patrol, how far would you go? What sort of distance would you cover?
Difficult to say. I don't know, it would be 10, 15 kilometres maybe. Oh, quite large distances. You weren't just sitting outside your own perimeter. You were moving into the desert to see where, if anything, there was likely to be any Germans around or anything to discover. But that's all I remember. I remember the detail of the patrol rather than its function.
Yes. How long would you be out then?
Sometimes only a day, sometimes overnight, and back the next day. Not longer than that. We weren't anything like the LRDG, you know, that disappeared behind enemy lines.
Yes. And how would you actually get the vehicles deployed? Was there a particular formation you normally employed for patrolling into?
Oh, fairly widely deployed. Because remember, in a flat desert, the dust is kicked up and you can see either the enemy can see you and you can see them for miles away because of dust clouds.
Did you ever do any patrolling at night, or was it all daylight?
No, we tend to lager at night in those sort of patrols. You would come together in a sort of typical, it's a South African term, I believe, isn't it?
Mm.
That you had all-round defence at that time, at night.
And can you remember how often you did have visual contact with the enemy doing the same sort of thing?
I suppose during the time before the real battle started, I must have done maybe four or five of that sort of patrol. Not all that number, but enough.
But did you see the enemy on every occasion?
Yeah, I'm talking about times when we did
see
them. When we did see people, yes.
And did they ever attempt to
attack us? Mm. Not that I remember. Mm. And I would have remembered that, I think.
Did you see anything of the Italians? You mentioned Germans.
Well, I'm sorry, yes. I mentioned Germans because I think in terms of Germans. Mm. They, for all I know, they would be Italians. In fact, they were Italians when we broke out initially.
And the defence position you were in, you presumably, did you have a platoon sector to hold in the box?
In the box, yes. You were dug in with a section and you were wired. And you stood two in the morning and you stood two at sundown in the evening. But apart from if there was nothing happening and there was no intelligence that anything was going to happen, you were then training or moving out or doing exercises of one sort or another. We had to learn to get into a vehicle and deploy fast, so we would move within the box area probably, and then you had to, you know, learn to jump out while it was still going, and all that sort of stuff.
How do you deploy fast from a vehicle?
Well, the only way we did at that time was to drop the back thing and jump out when it wasn't going fast enough.
So you just went over the tailboard?
Went over the tailboard, more or less, yes. But it's quite a technique. You might as well learn how to do it properly.
Of course.
As I remember.
When you arrived at the position, did you dig your own positions, or did you take over positions already prepared?
In the Gazala box?
Yes.
Oh, I think we had a... I can't remember. I quite frankly can't remember. I have a feeling that we were constantly digging ourselves foxholes of one sort or another, because you could move around, you could be moved within that box, of course, during the 2 weeks we were there.
Were you digging one-man pits or two-man pits?
Mostly, I think, one-man. Gazala Desert wasn't too bad to dig into, so you could get reasonable cover. As I recall, I'm not too certain, but you could get reasonable cover.
So how deep could you get?
I suppose I'm even at a reasonable cover. I'm only talking about 2 or 3 feet top bat.
Mm. So you'd be able to sit in
your... Yes, I would think so. To get a decent firing position for whatever angle of fire that you have to hold.
How was the platoon laid out? How were the sections of the platoon?
No idea, I can't remember. Quite frankly.
And do you remember whether you would be in the middle of the platoon or whether you would be with the forward section?